Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining me today on the roundtable, Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning.
Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Natalie Fahmy, state house reporter for NBC4. Welcome back, Natalie.
Happy Monday.
The Ohio House passed their version of the state budget. It's not a done deal, but if the House Republicans have their way, school funding in the state will undergo significant changes. Libraries will have millions restored, but with future funding up in the air. And the Cleveland Browns will win big, not necessarily on the football field, but in their finances, scoring $600 million in bonds to build a new stadium. Now, not everyone is a fan of this plan, and now the Cincinnati Bengals have their hand out as well. Republican House Speaker Matt Huffman spoke of the significance of the House's two-year, $61 billion funding plan.
I think this is the most consequential budget that I've been in, and this is now my 17th year in the General Assembly.
Democratic Minority Leader Alison Russo said the budget doesn't go far enough and called the cuts that are in there reckless.
Oh, I agree. It is very consequential, and it is consequential in that it will be extremely damaging.
Now, Jesse, we'll start with you. There's a lot to unpack here. Let's start with the K-12 school funding. Under DeWine's plan, he allocated $23.4 billion on education. His plan had fully funded the two-year fair school funding plan, but the House is taking a different approach. What do you think?
Yeah, so there are two elements of the school funding plan that passed through the House that I think are important. One is like how much money schools are getting initially. So Governor DeWine's plan actually would have cut funding to the tune of about $100 million across hundreds of school districts, in part because he was using some like outdated numbers to get to his final amount.
Right. He said it was still using the fair funding formula, but it wasn't maybe the most recent numbers.
Right. You can use the formula, but if you're using numbers from a few years ago, we've had a thing called inflation if you've been to the grocery store recently. And so that impacted what schools would actually get. So what the House did is they went in and made sure that no school was losing money from this current year into the next budget. But they really ditched this fair school funding plan that was initially approved 4 years ago. It was supposed to be a six-year plan that was rolled out over three different budgets. And House Republicans say that this plan is going to be too expensive to the tune of $1.8 billion. And so they came up with kind of their own formula. So that's one part of it. The other part is this property tax idea that they have, which is essentially if schools are holding a surplus of over 30% of like their finances, essentially that a portion of that money would be returned to schools. Basically, like the property tax board in the local county would say, like, here's some money back. They would not be taking the money from the schools, but there mm-hmm. would be some like refund mechanism to locals. And so that's how House Republicans are saying, you know, this is massive property tax relief that everyone has been asking for.
Now, we'll dig into the property tax relief in a second, but, there's a lot to this, and it's not surprising that the House decided to take a different approach. House Speaker Matt Huffman called the fair school funding formula unsustainable. So, Natalie, what do you make of the way that they are approaching this when it comes to the money?
You know, they say a lot that this budget is, you know, we're, quote, back to normal. The past couple budget cycles, we've had a lot of extra money from the federal government because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So they're kind of using the fact that we don't have all those federal funds and the one-time funding anymore to kind of say we have to make some tough choices here. And this might be one of the areas we have to make that tough choice, and we can't have this formula in place that relies on us having the same amount of money every single year if the next year we might not have that money. Of course, you know, that's kind of their explanation on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, they're like, school funding should be a priority, point blank, period. So just an interesting back and forth there, and kind of Democrats like to say it shows whose priorities are where.
Yeah, and Julie, we had someone from the Fordham Institute on the show talking about school funding, and he basically said that the schools are getting the most money they've ever gotten, so they should be happy. You know, everyone smiles when you say that, but like, what does that mean if the schools are getting the most money ever, but the, you know, some say it's still not enough?
Right. So we have a system of a school funding in this state that has, you know, decades of a backstory to it. It's been declared unconstitutional with the idea that it's over-reliant on property taxes. So if you live in a wealthier district, you get more money than if you live in a poorer district. And so this most recent iteration of fixing that, which there have been many, was in 2021. And it's, to me, it's somewhat surprising. And we did ask Huffman about this when he initially said he was going to abandon the 2021 plan, which, as Jesse said, was supposed to be rolled out over several budget cycles. That just seems surprising because obviously the Republicans have been in charge this whole time. It's their plan. It wasn't Matt Huffman's plan, but apparently, you know, that's part of the issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, yes, they're always going to get a little bit more money because of inflation and because cost of living, you know, rises in this country generally. And so budgets go up. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're being made whole, I guess, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. Year over year.
Now, we mentioned the controversial provision that caps how much money a school district can carry over. The original idea was 25%. Through negotiations, they changed to 30%, you know, a little numbers massaging there. That means that districts are allowed to carry over in their budget year over year a 30%. Are we calling this a rainy day fund?
That's one way. Yeah. I don't think there's like an official term. So surplus, rainy day fund, reserves, however you want to think of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So but right now some districts have more than 30%. And so that's what the Republicans in the House are saying, is that districts shouldn't have this extra money.
I think it's like 428-ish districts that have more than 30% of their budget. So Republicans in the House who are in favor of this proposal say that government shouldn't be, quote, a piggy bank, and they shouldn't just be allowed to hoard all this extra money. The schools argue, though, that, you know, they might be planning ahead for something long term, or, you know, their payroll just might happen to roll over on that day and they might have excess money in those situations. It's also criticized because as far as bringing property tax relief, some people are concerned that it's going to bring this one-time massive property tax relief worth billions of dollars to Ohioans all across the state. Like I said, in 428 of our 600-some school districts in Ohio, the problem is the school districts might have that carryover funds when this budget goes into effect, but then after that, they're going to spend down to make sure they are below that 30% in theory. So then the property tax relief portion of that will kind of be moot and it'll end up flattening out again. So it'll be interesting to see how in action, if this does pass, this actually does play out. But it's really the first overarching property tax proposal that's gotten this close to passing the state house, I would say.
Yeah, Julie.
I know, at least in my school district, I live in Worthington, you know, school districts plan, they usually have 5-year plans, sometimes longer. But, you know, one of the things is that they have to decide over time how much is something going to cost. For example, they're building a new high school in Worthington. That doesn't get done in one budget cycle for them. So, you know, they have to plan that kind of thing ahead. And then they also have to decide based on their budgets, local levies and how much you're going to, as the local taxpayer, pay on top of what you're paying in your state taxes and your federal taxes. So, you know, that's one of the arguments for them having a little bit of cushion in their budgets as opposed to paying it down every single time.
Yeah, I read an interview. It wasn't about Worthington, but it was about a treasurer saying that they have more than 30% right now because they're building a building. But as soon as he pays his contractor on the, you know, they have dates when they pay, right, you know, for progress, right? And as soon as he pays his contractor, then all that extra money will be gone. So he was just basically saying it, like, do they get to pick what day they decide when the 30% is looked at? You know, like, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And these are some of the details that, because this plan really is only like a week and a half old, that we need to drill down on. I think there will be a number of hearings on the budget in the Senate, because that's who now has the ball on this, or the baton on this relay race. And so we'll see, number one, if the Senate keeps this plan in place. And number two, like, what some of those nuances, what is the deadlines? Like, are there exceptions? There was a lawmaker on the House floor said, you know, I'm going to vote for this, but I really wish there were some exceptions for maybe some scenarios. Like Julia was talking about, another reason why schools might have more money right now is because of what Natalie touched on, is there was a lot of federal funding that was given at all levels of government. So we'll see how that is. And then just one other point, as far as property tax relief, it isn't going to be kind of uniform across the state. For example, Columbus City Schools is above that 30% threshold, but Cincinnati Schools is sitting at about 10% of reserves. So that would be no property tax relief for the people who live in that school district.
And what's really interesting about this proposal, too, is last General Assembly, there was this whole property tax study committee, and they ended up back in January coming out with a very lengthy report, and they had more, I think, a dozen or so proposals on there. A lot of them were bipartisan, some of them were partisan, but just property tax relief ideas, whether it was extending the homestead exemption or a circuit breaker, things like that. And we never really saw this on that. And that's something that a lot of lawmakers are bringing up too. Look, we have all these ideas. We already have like 16 or so bills that are introduced and having hearings. And all of a sudden, we've come up with this idea. No one's vetted it. No one knows a lot about it at this point.
Does anyone know, has anyone heard or anything from the Senate? I mean, are they inclined to go back to Governor DeWine's plan, or has anyone had any reaction on whether they like the House plan?
The Senate president kind of said last time I chatted with him, he said pretty much every question we asked him about the budget, we'll have to wait and see when it's in my chamber, when I really get a chance to look at it. I don't know, someone might no more, though.
I was just going to say that Senate President Rob McCauley was sort of a protege of Matt Huffman, as your listeners recall, that Matt Huffman, who's the House Speaker, just came from being Senate mm-hmm. President. And he's previously been in the House, too. So he knows his way around, and he has very loyal followers and things like that. But I think Rob McCauley has made known, like, I'm not just going to be a rubber stamp for everything that Matt Huffman does in the House. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, there are lots of pieces of this, mm-hmm. and a budget bill has to be, you know, sometimes things go in one section, like education, in order to get votes for something else, like Medicaid or something.
And Jesse, you co-wrote an article about Stark County and how it illustrates. The article called it a roller coaster of school funding. So is that kind of what you were alluding to, that each year the district will have to like figure out something else?
Yeah, I think that is some of the concern that is being brought up by local school districts, is just their ability to budget long term, which I think is helpful for your personal finances and helpful for school finances as well. Just kind of knowing what to expect. Mm.
This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and we're talking with Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Natalie Falmy, state House and politics reporter for NBC4, and Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. One thing that was seen as kind of a win when it came to the House budget was library funding. Julie, there was an outcry by libraries over funding cuts, and then the House ended up putting it back in, but changing it slightly. Could you explain what happened with the libraries?
Well, I do know that, you know, there was so much of an outcry from the trenches. Ohio loves its libraries. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to defer to someone else on exactly what happened. Yeah. Apologies.
Yeah, that's okay. You know, so basically the House eliminated, was it called the Public Library Fund? I can't remember the name of it now.
Yeah, so the way libraries are funded right now, it's called the Public Library Fund. It gets a certain percentage of taxes or revenue. And Governor Mike DeWine, when he initially pitched the budget, wanted to increase that percentage. And so that would have given schools, you know, much more money than they are receiving right now. So libraries were excited. And then the House budget comes out, and what they were doing was kind of eliminating this fund, but instead turning it into like a line item. So this is the exact number you're getting versus this is a percentage you're getting. In some regards, and what House Republicans' argument is, it's easier to know what exact number they're getting that way versus the percentage goes up and down. And so I think that's where a lot of the confusion about how much money these libraries were getting was coming from, because right now the percentage would be like something like $530 million for this fiscal year, but we don't have like the final number out. And so if the final number for 25 is $530 million, then what the House is proposing is closer to $490 and $500 million. So that would be a little bit less, but we still just don't have like that final number. That's why this gets so confusing so quickly.
Well, and Natalie, the idea that it seems like libraries were losing a lot of money in the House budget also came on the back of they're losing money at the federal level, too. So everyone kind of just panicked and said, what about the libraries, right?
Yeah. I think so. There's just so much uncertainty right now, especially in this budget season, from both the federal and the state level, exactly how things are going to play out and what things are going to end up looking like.
Yeah, so President Trump has talked about getting rid of funding for an overarching sort of board entity that helps disseminate federal government money to libraries. And so the question is sort of what then happens to the money?
That question is coming up a lot lately, I think, with what happens to the money. Well, we are going to devote an entire hour on Wednesday on All Sides. We're going to discuss federal and state funding challenges for both libraries and the Ohio Humanities. So be sure to tune in for that. And in just a moment, we are going to talk about that $600 million that is going to the Cleveland Browns in the Ohio budget. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us in the studio, Natalie Fahmy, Ohio State House and Politics Bureau reporter for NBC4. Thanks again for being here, Natalie.
Always.
And Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter with the Associated Press. Hi again, Julie.
Happy to be here.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks again for being here, Jesse.
Go sports teams.
All right, because we're going to talk about some sportsing right now. All right, so Governor DeWine and the House Republicans are on two different wavelengths when it comes to how to help the Cleveland Browns build a new domed stadium in Brook Park in the Cleveland area. So not everyone wants to use public money to help the billionaires who own the Browns, the Haslams, build this stadium. So, Julie, would you like to start and discuss? Basically, it did stay in the budget. The House wants to give $600 million in bonds to help the Browns build the stadium.
Right. So putting aside for a second, you know, this question you just brought up of whether or not the budget should include money for a single team in a single city, which is one of the big debates that I think will have to happen in the Senate. So the governor's budget did have the money for the Browns Dome Stadium. $600 million in his budget was an increase in taxes on our relatively fledgling sports gaming industry. This has been one of his things. He doubled the tax on it in the last budget. He's doubling it again, 20% to 40%. So that was his idea, and basically that this would be an ongoing sort of funding stream. The House does not like that because obviously, I mean, the House, when you think about that chamber, this is the most, this is the closest to the average Ohio voter, right? They have the smallest districts. They have to run more often than the Senate. And they are beholden kind of to the Republican base here, which is not going to be very happy about tax increases.
Yeah, doubling the tax on sports betting is right. Where he wanted to get this fund from, but then that impacts individual people more than like some $600 million bond situation, right?
Right. So what they basically are arguing now is like, let's do this as we will make available municipal bonds to for sale to fund this. The Browns will come up with a little bit more to feed the kitty at the beginning. And then they believe that this is almost revenue neutral, as I'm understanding it. It's, you know, they're saying that it's going to be $1 billion in bonds over 30 years, but that the $40 million per year that will cost Ohio taxpayers basically will be made up for in the property taxes that will come and the other taxes that will come from this giant entertainment complex in Brook Park, which is a suburb of Cleveland. And the idea is that this is not just for sports, that once it's domed, of course, they can get through those hard Cleveland winters. They can host events year round. They can draw in Super Bowls maybe and Final Fours and the things that they can't really do. Mm-hmm. With an open air stadium on Lake Erie. But, you know, this is not without tons of controversy. Cleveland really objects to them moving in the first place. They've tried to invoke this Modell law, which is named for Art Modell, who took the Cleveland Browns notoriously to Baltimore in 1999. And so they've said, listen, we passed a law after that said you can't undercut a city. Your host city has to be given notice, has to be given a chance to buy the team before you can move. Mm-hmm. Now the Browns are saying, well, we're not really moving. We're going down the road 15 miles.
We'll call them the Brook Park Browns instead of Cleveland Browns now. Yeah.
And, you know, they basically object to it and have legally filed a challenge in the courts to say that the Modell law is unconstitutional. Cleveland has countersued, et cetera. So that's where we stand with the Browns funding.
And that lawsuit will go on forever. Natalie or Jesse, if you were watching the House debate when the budget was on the floor, this was a contentious issue. I mean, there were amendments being thrown around. It got very confusing. And it was all related to this Browns money, right? Were you watching all that come out?
It was one of the more controversial, interestingly enough, aspects of this budget. There were several attempted amendments, but something like that was really interesting strategically that I didn't even know was, you know, maybe let's say there were six lawmakers who wanted to amend this Browns funding before any of that was able to happen. Chair of the Finance Committee, Brian Stewart, offered an amendment. So all of those amendments were then out of order and can't really amend an amendment kind of thing. So kind of, in effect, blocked any other attempt from amending it. The chair's amendment was right now, well, previously the Browns had to give $38.5 million up front for this bond, which would then grow and help cover the cost of the bond. Now they increase that number to $50 million, and it's estimated that it will grow to $250 million, according to the finance chair, over 25 years to help cover the bond if, for whatever reason, tax revenue and revenue from the stadium doesn't make up for it. So I think to me and to most other reporters, that might signify that the Browns plan in itself didn't have the votes until they went back to the Haslams and said, hey, you guys got to give us a little bit more money to get this done. And then they were able to get the rest of the votes that they may have needed. What was also really interesting about that amendment is I think there were like 26 no votes. So a lot of people didn't actually put their name on the board to say where they stood on this issue.
Now, Democratic Representative Sean Brennan talked about other ways that he wants this money to be used. He did not want it to go to the Browns.
And folks who advocate for funding centers that help victims of sexual violence and food banks and so many other causes that help the needy. They share their heart-wrenching stories and have to grovel for pennies from the State House.
So there was a lot of debate about this. I would say that this is a very contentious issue for a lot of people. I'm not sure how it all breaks down, if Republicans, if they're from the Clevelandish area, if they like it or not. But there a lot of people were standing up and saying, there's other ways I want this money to be used. Were you hearing that?
Yeah, there's a really interesting amalgamation of people who are opposed to this. You have a lot of Democrats who don't like this plan because they, you know, want the money to be spent in other ways, Representative Brennan outlined in your clip there. But you also have Republicans who think we should not be spending money or taking out bonds for sports stadiums. You have people who have made pledges to organizations to not raise taxes. And so you have kind of some of the more conservative members of the Ohio House voting in line with some of the most liberal members of the Ohio House. And there was one particular vote that very nearly passed that was kind of a symbol of that. And I think that could come back if we get into a scenario where this bond package makes it into the budget, Governor Mike DeWine vetoes it, and you're going to have to try to do an override. As it stands right now, they're not going to have the votes to do that.
Now, and then, as predicted, a week later, you know, the Cincinnati Bengals come out and say, oh, you're giving away money or bonds or whatever. It doesn't matter. We want some, right?
Yeah, I think this concept is not shocking to anyone who has children. If you give one kid a toy, another kid also would like a toy or an ice cream or so forth.
More than one sportsing team happens here.
Not that a giant dome stadium is an ice cream cone. But so the Bengals basically came out with a package mid last week saying they wanted $350 million for upgrades to Paycor Stadium, which is where the Bengals play. And talking with lawmakers, this has been kind of floating around. The House Finance Chair, Brian Stewart, said that he first heard generally from the Bengals or Hamilton County in February, but didn't really have a number or a full plan until shortly before the House was passing the budget. So I think it's safe to say that the Bengals are certainly less organized than the Browns are on this lobbying effort. But it's possible that this is going to play out in the Senate. I do think this was a concern that Governor Mike DeWine raised from the beginning with having just this one particular plan for one particular sports team, that other people are going to come. And what is your plan for them?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Everyone wants to talk about this. Yes, go.
I was just going to say that's why Governor Mike DeWine, wanted to fund sports stadiums. He didn't say specifically the Brown stadiums, but sports facilities through increasing that sports gaming tax, because that way it creates a long-term fund. So next time a sports team comes knocking on the legislature's door, they're like, okay, we have this dedicated fund that can be used for that. How much money do we have in this fund? How much can we fund you? That sort of thing.
Yeah, and his office had told me that, we have many stadiums around the state of Ohio, professional sports stadiums that were built around the 1990s, and their sort of natural life is about 30 years. So it's an issue that the governor thinks is going to be ongoing and needs some kind of a funding stream.
Right. And so, what's to stop the Columbus Blue Jackets from coming next, the Toledo Mudhens, the Dayton Dragons? There's all of these teams. The minor league teams are going to want some money too, and it just is going to be a snowball effect.
Right. And I did ask about Ohio Stadium, and of course, they decided to leave that out of their plan because it would be under higher education funding, which is another whole animal.
Ohio Stadium and Ohio State comes under the higher education part.
In other words, this fund would not go to university stadiums. It would go to professional stadiums.
I see. Yes, convenient, right? There you go. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and with us we have Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press, Natalie Fahmy, Ohio State House and Politics Bureau reporter for the NBC4, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. There were a lot of other provisions kind of hidden into the budget, and we were talking off air that, right now they're on a break, right? So let's get a status update. So the budget is in the Senate, and then they're taking a 2-week break. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's Easter is this coming weekend, other religious ceremonies around this time, and so they are not meeting for session for the next 2 weeks. So basically, the governor had his version, then the House had their version. It goes to the Senate. the House and Senate inevitably won't be on the same page about everything in this, you know, 1,000-plus page document. So they'll have to hash out the differences before it goes to DeWine, and then DeWine has the opportunity to line item veto. So, like, pick individual parts of this budget he doesn't like and reject them.
So this whole process will take until June, right?
Right. And we've heard that probably the governor aims to come back mid-June with his, or to get that piece done in mid-June with the idea that maybe they could come back and look at his line items and see if they want to veto. Because although everybody's Republican in this scenario, they're not all on the same page. But constitutionally, we have to balance our budget, and we have to do so by July 1.
Well, one other thing I wanted to talk about before we take a break is not budget related, but there's a movement afoot to put a referendum to voters to repeal the controversial higher education bill, also known as Senate Bill 1. So this kind of came out late last week. The higher education bill did pass, and it will go into law, I guess, 90 days from whenever it was signed. But there's a movement to try to basically repeal it. Can someone give me an update on that movement? Yeah, Jesse?
Yeah, so this was actually kind of a small group of Youngstown State University professors who got together and said, hey, no one else is trying to put this on the ballot for an up or down vote from Ohio citizens, and so we're going to do it. And referendum efforts are extremely hard to do because you need to collect hundreds of thousands of signatures in that 90-day period before the law takes effect. The most recent successful referendum was Senate Bill 5. Which was anti-collective bargaining, anti-union law back in 2011. The most recent, like, really serious attempt was House Bill 6, that controversial energy bill that was at the heart of a pay-to-play scandal. And so these things are just really hard to do. I talked with AAUP, which is representing professors and faculty and so forth. They were the main voice opposing Senate Bill 1, and they themselves are not, like, pushing for a referendum just because it's very hard, it's very expensive, and there are kind of other fights that they're looking to do in the courts. But I thought this particular effort was interesting. It showed kind of that grassroots opposition to Senate Bill 1. And so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah,
right. I mean, over the recent years, we have seen the ability to make it to Ohio's ballot get harder and harder. I don't know specifically to referendums if there have been changes, but, you know, it's not, as Jesse says, it's very difficult to do. It has to be percentages within certain counties and
getting signatures from every county now, that's required. And it used to just be the number of signatures, but don't you have to have someone from every county? Is that true? Or
I think that that is the case for constitutional amendments. I'm not sure about referenda, but my first Latin word of the day.
Yeah, I had heard that there were different pieces and parts. They were going to try to take the higher education bill, Senate Bill 1, and maybe file a lawsuit against this particular part of it, like kind of like line by line instead of the whole entire bill. Do you think that that will still happen despite this referendum effort?
I definitely think so. You know, a lot of bills that come out of the state house these days end up in the courts. I think probably what's going to happen is some sort of temporary stay is going to be put on the bill as the case moves forward. So it might be put on hold for a couple of weeks or something like that. It's what we tend to see happen before the bill goes into effect. But yeah, it's very likely.
Yeah, I think there's really two ways that you can go about this. One is a challenge before the law takes effect, and ideas that they've thrown out there are a challenge to the First Amendment. Like, are you restricting what professors or the university or anyone else can do as far as speech? And the First Amendment being, you know, one of the big ones, it's very well protected. So that's one aspect. Or alternatively, you wait till the law takes effect, and then, you know, you have a student who can't get a scholarship that they previously had access to. So that's the other route you can go about.
Right. And there have been efforts underway with regard to courts as well that are not, they haven't been completed yet, but a lot of the ruling Republicans in Ohio support the idea that a common pleas court in a certain county couldn't, that it's ruling on something like that. For example, putting a stay on a state law wouldn't be have a statewide impact. It would only be in the county where they are. And this is one of the ways they're trying to kind of weaken that direct democracy process.
Oh, that's interesting. So it could go into effect in all the other counties except one county?
Right.
Well, that's not complicated. Great. Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will talk about the fact that Ohio has a primary election coming up and there happens to be a statewide issue on that ballot. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This is All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jarovich. Still with us, we have Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter with the Associated Press, Natalie Fahmy, Ohio State House and Politics Bureau reporter for NBC4, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And Ohio has a primary election coming up soon, May 6th, and there is a statewide issue to vote on. I actually saw a sign for it the other day in my neighborhood of Clintonville. It's called Issue 2, and it's a $2.5 billion public works program. Natalie, what exactly does this money go to?
So it goes to pretty much local infrastructure projects, excuse me. So like sewer lines, roads, bridges, that sort of thing, all at the local level. This bonds program, it's called the SCIP, was created back in 1987 by two lawmakers who are still in the legislature. And, you know, it passed then, and then it's been passed several times afterwards, every 10 years or so. So, like, I think it was 95, 2005, 2015. Overwhelmingly, voters have approved this every single time. Last time it was a $2 billion thing. But county engineers essentially say this is really important because without it, we're not going to be getting that direct money into local construction projects. You're going to notice a difference in roads. Projects like if a water main line breaks, it might take a little bit longer to get done, things like that. There was very little opposition to this. I think five lawmakers in the whole entire legislature voted against putting this on the ballot again this May. One of the reasons being they think there are better ways to fund this. They don't think the money equitably goes to every county and every single local government. They think we need to kind of restructure the system that's been in place for 4 decades. They say it's kind of outdated. I do think it will be really interesting to see, given our economic climate, whether voters are inclined to approve $2.5 billion in bonds, even though it's not a direct tax increase. Someone might see $2.5 billion and might take them aback a bit.
Well, I consider myself to be a fairly in-the-know person because I host the show once a week, and so I know what's going on. And I saw that sign pop up when I was driving my daughter to dance, and I was like, and this on the side of the road, it said, vote yes on issue two. And I said, what's issue two? So I was like, how do people know about this?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on that it could be a little bit confusing because this is the first cycle when it would typically have been issue one. Because every election you start fresh and you start counting. And so, you know, it looks like issue two, like, wow, now I'm even more lost because what's issue one and why is this only the second one? But actually, this is the first one. And the reason we did that is that lawmakers felt that it was getting very confusing. If we all remember back to 2023, we had an issue one on the 60% rule for the state constitution. Then we had an issue one on abortion, and then we had an issue one on redistricting. And so it becomes like, you know, it comes a little hard. Plus, you know, those people who support those can just reuse their signs.
Right. What, how do we know whether to say yes or no to issue one when everything seems to be issue one? So, Jesse, tell us about the new numbering system.
Yeah. So essentially, we're just going to keep going up and up and up until we hit the number 500. When I was talking to one of the lawmakers behind this about why they picked 500, he said they didn't want to get to an issue 666. So it was just kind of a random. After issue 500, we'll reset to issue one. But in the world of, you know, everything is online, all of our articles are online. If you're Googling what is issue one, to Julie's point, you might get something about redistricting, abortion, or, you know, constitutional amendment limits. So
yeah, you have to pay attention to the year and the month of what issue one is. Yes.
So with issue two, this is not about marijuana. It's about super exciting local infrastructure projects. And to your point about why you haven't heard as much about issue two, number one, it's on a primary ballot when there maybe isn't a lot else on these ballots. It's not a governor year. It's not a presidential year. Some cities might be having mayoral primaries, but it's not like a super exciting election coming up, except for, you know, those who are personally involved, I'm sure.
I care a lot about knowing what's going on, and I thought, what is this? Yes,
right.
Now I know, and now everyone listening knows. So if you see that sign, you know what issue two is. So, but basically, voters will go into the booth and they'll read it, and it'll say a lot of words about bonds and money and public works projects, and then people tend to vote yes on these type of things, right, Natalie?
I think the lowest percentage it passed by was in 2005 at like 54%, but every other year it's been like high 60s, low 70s. It has overwhelmingly passed nearly every single time except that once that it was 54, which, you know, still 4% more than they needed. So
Yeah. And then just one other indication of the support, like Natalie said, Democrats, Republicans voted for this. Only 5 members of the legislature voted against it. And when the ballot board goes in and they have to get arguments like for and against each issue, there wasn't even like a group organized enough to do a here's why you should vote against this issue. So the ballot board just had to come up with some language themselves.
Okay. Well, so I guess that for those 5 people who didn't like it, they'd have to come up with their own new funding plan of how to do this, right? That might be hard too. All right. Well, in the time we have left, the House passed their budget, and there's a lot of basically random things in the budget that you wouldn't even realize are in the state budget. And I mean, I have a long list of them, but I think we'll have each reporter here just talk about maybe something they've written about or their favorite lesser known highlight of the House budget. Who would like to go first?
I guess I can. It's lesser known. It's gotten some attention from these 2 fine reporters in the room, though. The budget has a number of LGBTQ impacting policies. One is that it would declare that Ohio only has 2 genders, male and female. And, you know, this is not unlike the, you know, marriages between one man and one woman, which we've seen in this state before. And then also it has some random things like you can only fly a POW flag in addition to the American flag and the Ohio flag. You can't, which means you can't fly rainbow flags at government buildings, that kind of thing. And it limits where libraries can place and make available certain texts that relate to these topics.
And some would ask, why does that belong in the budget, right? Maybe. I would ask that, I guess. So the House budget, as you said, does include these provisions aimed at the LGBTQ community. It would prohibit Medicaid funding from going to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. That and other changes got a full-throated endorsement from Republican Representative Gene Schmidt. We have that cut.
This budget pushes back against the wokeness we are facing by prohibiting Medicaid funds from being used for discriminatory DEI programs and establishing a statewide policy recognizing there are only 2 sexes.
Yeah, so the budget has those provisions that you mentioned, Julie, about the books, and then it has the thing about the flags. It also would bar funding for youth homeless shelters that, quote, promote or affirm social gender transitions. I mean, that's very specific.
Right. And I mean, to your question of why would you put this in a budget? I mean, the most lawmakers want to get to a yes on the budget bill. It's the largest document and policy blueprint that any session passes over 2 years. So they want to get to a yes. And a lot of people will hold their nose on something like provisions like this in order to say, yes, I supported Medicaid or an increase in education funding, that kind of thing. And so that's why.
Hmm. All right. Well, how about you, Natalie? Is there something else that is in the budget that one would not expect? Your favorite random part of the budget?
So this one's a little bit wonky, but there's a policy in there to direct the state to ask the federal government for a waiver to allow Ohio to restrict what Ohioans can spend SNAP benefits on, specifically targeting sugar sweetened drinks, aka pop / soda, whatever you call it.
Pop. Okay.
Yes. So essentially, they want to make it so in Ohio, if you have SNAP benefits, you cannot buy pop with it. The finance chair says buying pop with SNAP benefits is pretty much subsidizing, quote, diabetes in children. So he thinks, you know, if people are using their own money, they can buy whatever they want to. The beverage industry kind of pushes back and says this is a personal freedom issue. Anyone should be able to buy what they want, whether it's on food stamps or not on food stamps. So I just think that's a really interesting part. It's, like I said, a little bit wonky because the state can't unilaterally do this. They have to get permission from the federal government in order to do that. But
that sounds like something, you know, the new Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., that I've heard him say that exact thing. Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't seem like if this does pass in the budget, I don't think it will be much of an uphill battle for the state to gain that waiver. But I just do think it's an interesting policy to have in there and to see them taking such strong stances against specifically buying pop on food stamps.
All right, Jesse, your turn. Favorite random thing in the budget.
There's a lot in here on higher education, and I think it's just interesting coming off of Senate Bill 1 just passing. One provision that's interesting is there's this Governor Merit Scholarship that goes to some of the top high school students in Ohio. The goal is to keep them in the state of Ohio, and right now they can spend that on public or private universities. But in order to use this scholarship at a private university going forward, those private universities would have to adopt some of the changes included in Senate Bill 1. So bans on diversity, equity, and inclusion, posting syllabi online, you know, some of the faculty reviews and post-tenure reviews. And this is interesting because the private universities, so Dayton, Kenyon, Otterbein, et cetera, were not subject to Senate Bill 1. It was really only applying to your public universities. So this is an interesting kind of like backdoor way to get these universities to come into compliance with these rules as well.
So if a student wants to use the governor's scholarship at a private university, they can only pick a private university that is willing to agree to do the Senate Bill 1 things.
Correct. You got it.
Interesting. Okay. I'm going to leave that there because I don't even know what else to say about that. And then in the couple of minutes we have left, there's a new documentary, Ohio Confidential, that shines a spotlight on the state. And it's not necessarily a flattering look. Here's a clip at the first part of the two-part documentary that's going to air on Max.
Dark money led to the biggest case of political corruption in the history of Ohio.
In 2019, there was an investigation involving Matt Borges and Neil Clark. Neil had been one of the most powerful lobbyists in the history of the state.
So this documentary has been a long time in coming. I do feel compelled to say that this was the subject of the 2023 podcast by WOSU reporter Renee Fox called The Power Grab. So basically, it is a documentary from Max, formerly HBO, that is just looking at Larry Householder and the whole basically House Bill 6 case. Have you seen the preview, Julie?
I have. So super excited to see how they put it all together, because, you know, your podcast was amazing in that the audio that was available was incredible. I mean, I think some of the visuals that they'll then be able to add to this, and, you know, as a print reporter, You know, I don't necessarily always get to have fun with all the bells and whistles, but, you know.
Yeah, those FBI recordings, I mean, some of them were just, you know, we had to do some audio enhancement on it. So I'm interested to see if they have any, like, play actors in this documentary or something like that. I don't know how they're going to do those, like, steak and lobster bisque dinners that they had when they made all these deals.
Right. And just as an aside, I did have my birthday celebration at the Aubergine last year because I really wanted to see where they had cut the deal. It was very exciting.
That is exciting. So is, I mean, they're having this documentary come out, but there's still parts of this case that are still happening, right? Like, it's not like we put to bed this whole entire issue, right?
Yeah, there are two former executives from First Energy who are charged with crimes related to this. So the case is still very much open. And then Ohio Attorney General has filed a number of state charges up in the Cleveland area against Householder and others. So it's still a very pending investigation.
Yeah. And Natalie, are you looking forward to a documentary that's very Ohio focused here?
Absolutely. I remember actually the HBO crew when SJR 2 passed, which was our August issue one constitutional amendment thing. There were tons of protests at the state house. They were there getting some footage of kind of the state house and the protests and things like that. And I saw some of that protest video in the documentary preview. So I'm going to be interested to see how they kind of tie together House Bill 6 with that video, since they're kind of unrelated. But I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah, they must have been working on this for a long time, because I know that, I mean, this is years ago. How many years?
Yeah, I think at least 2 years in production and so forth. And you can look for familiar faces, including my colleague, Laura Bischoff, who answers some of their questions.
All right. Well, we have just a few seconds left in the show, and I want to just say thank you to everyone. This has been the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and thank you to Jesse Ballmer, State Government Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Jesse.
Happy to be here.
And also thanks to Natalie Fahmy, Ohio State House and Politics Reporter for NBC4. Thank you.
It was a great time.
And Julie Carr-Smythe, Government and Politics Reporter with the Associated Press. Thanks, Julie.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. This is 89.7 NPR News.